transmitters to full. All receivers to boost. This is London calling. This is London calling.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret agent man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yes, we hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And welcome back to the Angry History Podcast, where today, guys, we are joined by a guest we've been looking forward to welcoming to the show for quite a long time. It's MC Fontaine, better known as Mark Cotton, who produces the Bletchley Park Podcast. He's been good enough to join us from the home of the Codebreakers in London. Mark, welcome.
Hello, gentlemen.
How's it going?
It's going very well. How are you two?
Great. Great to be talking with you, not on an email in the middle of the night for a change.
Yes.
It's the middle of your night, though, Mark.
It's just over midnight, so we're on the 31st now, so the last day of the year, and someone's birthday, I think.
That would be little old me. Thank you very much for remembering. That's very nice of you.
You're 30, right, Owen?
Yeah, in dog years. I don't know what the heck I am.
This week.
Well, we feel young whenever we're talking about history, and Mark has been really a great, great benefit getting to know you and talk about Bletchley Park and tell some people about it here and share what you do to preserve the memory of these veterans. I mean, this is fantastic what you're doing over there.
Thank you. I mean, it's why I do it. The entire reason for doing it is it's just my really small, insignificant way of thanking the veterans for their service, really, which I don't think we do enough of. And, you know, keeping those stories alive.
Aileen Hasdell, I worked for Y Group. We fed Bletchley Park with coded messages. There would have been no reason for Bletchley Park to be here without these messages that we intercepted. And they were all in code, German coded messages. And I used to wonder whether they were any good because, of course, you had to take these messages down through terrible interference and you wouldn't always get a complete message. They were always came over in blocks of five letters. Five Morse code letters, and you may not have got them all. And I used to think, what good is this? But we had stations all over the country. So say I got two letters out of a group of five. Somebody else might have picked up the other three. So when they came back to Bletchley Park, they had to sort all this sort of rubbish out and get it into some sort of order and then start decoding.
You know, younger people now, they are getting more into this sort of thing. They're getting more into history, and with Bletchley especially, because it's also, you know, the birthplace of computing. It's got that hook for them that, you know, that technology was involved, although a rather mechanical technology.
Absolutely, but certainly so easily traceable to where we are today,
thanks
in large part to Alan Turing, about whom we'll speak in a little while.
What you said there about young people, too, I was saying to Owen before we started broadcasting here that it's a fun place, Bletchley Park. It's a fun place. You do a lot of stuff for young people. You have groups like the Three Bells on there and you know, sing period music, a trio in the spirit of the Andrews Sisters. It looks like it's a fun place. It's not just a dry, you're going to walk through and see computers and such. You're really experiencing history there.
And these great dramatizations as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's an entire, obviously, with it being a you know, a heritage museum, there's an entire education side to it. So all the way through the year, there's always school trips coming and college groups coming. During the summer holidays, every week there's a sort of family fun days. So there's events put on for children, all different age groups as well. So, you know, it sort of brings them into sort of the code breaking story.
That's wonderful.
Before we get too far, we want to tell people that they could subscribe to the Bletchley Park Podcast on iTunes or listen to your Audio Boo channel. They can also follow you on Twitter at @BParkPodcast, right?
They certainly can.
Tell us the kind of things you do on the show for people who have never heard it. What are they going to hear when they subscribe or listen on Audio Boo?
We do a monthly podcast to start with. So on the 10th of every month, our monthly edition comes out. And we like to think of it as like a magazine program, but it's based on one place, basically. So we'll basically bring you reports from events that have been held there, sort of lectures and talks and and just public events that have been on.
Who does the show with you, Mark?
Catherine Lynch is the host of the show, or the talent, as I like to call her.
Right, and she is quite talented.
Oh, very talented, and really good pedigree as well.
Welcome to another Bletchley Park podcast extra.
There really is no predicting who will pop into Bletchley Park and what secrets they'll reveal about what happened here during World War II.
Catherine has worked for the BBC for years as a reporter and a producer and a presenter on radio mainly, but also television. So she wanted a bit of a change in her work-life balance. And because she'd been working on local radio, that was the local radio for where Bletchley is, she'd been doing lots of reports from there and lots of stories from there. And basically had just fallen in love with the place. And she wanted to do something to sort of make it more popular and make it more known to people. So when the job as media manager came up, I think she just jumped at it.
Fantastic.
Now, tell us about the Codebreakers and exactly what would have been happening at Bletchley Park. And nobody on the outside world would have known anything that was going on there. So what was really happening there that helped the Allies literally win the Second World War?
Its official title was the Government Code and Cipher School. So this originally had started in Room 40 in the Admiralty in World War One.
Okay.
So during World War One, a lot of the Codebreakers were linguists. It was based on words, really.
Sure.
By the time you got to World War Two, it was more mathematical. So they were looking for more mathematicians and not so much linguists. And, you know, they needed to have linguists to actually decipher the German into plain English.
Right.
But it was more crunching numbers, really. You know, and it was, you know, just breaking those codes through just sheer effort, really, to start with. The original house was a large house in an estate just outside Bletchley Bay, well, in Bletchley, just outside Milton Keynes. The house had gone up for sale in 1938, and it was about to be bought by a builder and turned, knocked down and turned into a housing estate.
Wow, man.
It's beautiful, by the way. That picture you said, this was
quite
great.
Lovely.
It's a real, if you ask an architect about the house, they're not quite so sure because it's such a weird mishmash of different styles. It's quite fitting, really, because it's quite eccentric in its architecture. And that probably really fits in with a lot of the more famous codebreakers that were there. Because your main sort of codebreakers that everyone knows about, you know, some of them would be described as quite eccentric. You know, I mean, Alan Turing, for example, you know, there's tales of him cycling to Bletchley in the morning with a gas mask on. That might sound weird, but it's quite logical when you realise that he had hay fever. So what's the best way to stop hay fever?
That's
it. I'll put my gas mask on. It just seems sensible.
It does seem sensible. Now, I listen to the show regularly, the podcast regularly. I always learn so much each time I listen, and coming from a lot of different angles. And now, some of the understanding that I've gotten is you have men like Turing and Sir Arthur Bonsall, from whom we'll hear in a little while, thanks to you. But it seems like a lot of the Wrens, the young women at the time who worked there, they were told to report there. And they were told to push this button, push this button, push this button. And they really didn't know what they were doing, right? I mean, they didn't know.
No, not
they didn't know the importance of their particular jigsaw piece.
I mean, most of them, if not all of them, knew that they were code breaking. You know, they were told, you will be code breaking. That's what we're doing here. We're breaking codes. But their little piece, because it was so compartmentalized, and it had to be that way just to keep everything secret. So literally one person in one hut would not know what someone in the next hut was doing.
Okay.
And that's the way they lived their lives there. And they all stuck to it. They, you know, they didn't try to find anything out because that was what they'd been asked to do.
It's amazing. This sense of sort of service without question to me is a fascinating one. And it's at the beating heart of the podcast. One thing I noticed, and I'm interested in you as an Englishman, and hearing you and hearing Catherine and hearing some of the people talking with the Wrens when they're at Bletchley, there is such pride that comes in through your voice and through Catherine's voice when you're with these people. This is not just any other job.
No, I mean, I do this as a volunteer for Bletchley. And you know, it is just the joy in getting to meet these veterans. And also the fact that sometimes, and quite often this happens, a lot of them will just say, well, I didn't do anything important here.
Right.
And we say to all of them, no, you were a small cog, but in a very big machine. And without what you were doing, the next bit wouldn't have worked.
Right.
And then the next bit wouldn't have worked. And just to see the sheer joy on their faces when you sort of explain that to them. And that, oh, right. Oh, so I was breaking Enigma. Yeah, you were part of breaking Enigma.
One of the things that I love about your show, about the Bletchley Park podcast, is something I find quite touching, and it was fascinating to listen to. You had shown a piece of equipment to this veteran, this former Wren, and she had the total recall that she seemed to have, not having seen this piece of equipment, you know, in 70 years, was just something else. Let's give a listen to this.
It looks very much like the place that I was in. Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah, that's lovely. I remember that. Yeah, you had to pay figures and D, and that brought up the call sign of the people that you were calling. I mean, if we were calling at Uxbridge, we were Central Signal Centre, and that was CENUXB. And we used to do the call sign and get that up, and then we used to put V, which that meant from, and then we were CSC, so we put VCSC, and then we type out from the written Morse, you know, and the messages. But anyway, yeah, that's it. Doesn't it look ancient now beside my electric typewriter? Yeah, this is the one.
So when was the last time you saw one of these?
1947, when I was demobbed.
Can I get a picture of you in front of that machine?
Okay.
It's what makes it worthwhile, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what should we get you to say? Teleprinter,
hello again.
Brilliant, thank you.
Dear old soul.
That was pure serendipity that day. I'd been there recording the links for that month's show and was literally about to go home, and the tour guide came running over to me and said, I've got two veterans on this tour. And we just basically followed them around for the rest of the day. And that particular one, Joyce Roberts, it was amazing. We knew where she'd worked mainly, which was an area called Block E, which is one of the concrete buildings.
Okay.
But she'd also said that later she'd worked in one of the huts. And quite often, because a lot of the huts look similar, and just through, you know, the passage of time, really, you can take them into a hut and they're, oh yeah, I definitely worked in here. So you do have to sort of be a little bit gentle with them and not say, well, no, you definitely couldn't have worked in here or whatever.
Right.
But with Joyce, that one, I mean, the best bit was as we left that hut, she said, yes, that's definitely where I work, because there's the toilet block just there. And it's not marked as a toilet block anymore. And to have known that that was the toilet block meant that she worked in there. But when we took her in to a room where there was a teleprinter, she literally, it was as if she was just going back on shift.
She's fascinating.
Straight over to it, her fingers were on the keys, and she's looking at me while she's pressing the keys saying, oh yeah, you pressed funked D, and then that did this, and this, and she was just off. And
it's amazing.
You could just watch the years just fall off her. It was fantastic.
It really is quite something. Now, talk about, you know, something wonderful for you to experience. Just
oh yeah, I mean, that's the payback for me. It's the honor of being in their presence, to be honest.
You think of that complex, it was so close to being torn down, wasn't it? And you mentioned the huts there a few times. Well, I know that there's various stages of rehabilitation and recovering them and rebuilding them, but tell us what the status of the huts is now.
In 1992, it was about to be bought by a builder and knocked down and turned into a housing estate, a supermarket and a petrol station, or a gas station. And some local history buffs, basically, people like probably yourselves, just basically said, no, we don't want this. This should be saved. You know, there's no two ways about it. I mean, the first thing they wanted to do was just get all the veterans that were left alive back together for a one-off reunion. This was their first thought, you know, just to say, you know, they can all say goodbye to the place.
Sure.
They thought they might get 50 people. I think there was 250 at the first reunion.
Wow.
And basically, from that point onwards, they set up the trust, and Milton Keynes Council have always been fully behind it. They stopped the planning permission. But, you know, from that day up till maybe 3-4 years ago, it's been a fight for the trust all that time to get money and just to save the buildings, because, you know, at the end of the day, they're really, the huts are no more than glorified garden sheds that were just thrown up really quickly because of the necessity during the war.
Sure.
And they weren't expected to, you know, probably to be there for 5 years or 10 years, let alone 70 years.
Mark, do you think that this notion of having it be so difficult to raise money for the trust, is it an apathy? Is it a natural generational sort of dimming? What do you think the challenge stems from?
I think a lot of it was due to the fact that people didn't know anything about Bletchley Park, because, you know, right, it was kept secret up till the 1970s. As the place has become more widely known, then, you know, the fundraising has been slightly easier. I don't imagine the fundraising team would say it's you know, a walk in the park on any day, you know, like any establishment, you know, there's so many calls on people these days for their money that, you know, it is a difficult thing to do. But at the moment, we're just coming into 2014. So this year will be a really big year for Bletchley because we were given a Heritage Lottery funded grant. So this is basically, there's a national lottery in Britain, and part of the money that comes into the lottery actually goes out to good causes, so it goes to charities and museums and things like that.
Right.
And Bletchley were lucky enough to get a rather substantial grant from that fund. So that's enabled them to basically take one of the largest concrete blocks that are on the site, which was known as Block C, which was completely and utterly derelict. There were trees growing through the roof. Half the roof was missing. Wow. It was, I mean, it looked like a horror movie set. I've been in there and it was awful. There were pigeons living in there. And that has been completely turned back to how it was in 1943.
Maybe even a little cleaner. Who knows?
It looks amazing. It's all the internal walls that were put in after the war. Because, I mean, the other thing about Bletchley is after the war, it was a site used by so many different people. It was used by the Civil Aviation Authority. It was used by British Telecom, who were at the time the national telephone subscriber, basically. It was a teacher training college. All different sections of it were used, but there was the actual story of what happened there during the war was all kept secret, basically. But the new visitor centre, which is going to open this summer, is just going to look absolutely amazing.
I cannot wait to see it.
And at the same time, they've managed to completely renovate two of the original huts. Now, these huts were literally falling down. And huts 3 and 6 are going to be open for the first time ever to the public this year.
That's great.
People can learn more. For one thing, I didn't give the web address. We're talking to Mark Cotton of the Bletchley Park podcast at Bletchley, that's Bletchley with an E-Y, park.org.uk. And tell us where it is, because this is a place people can get to pretty easily if they're visiting London, right? It's kind of off the beaten path. I find when people travel to the same place a lot, you know, they kind of feel like they've seen everything. And that's part of the reason I think you were saying people just didn't know it was there. And so we didn't grow up thinking, gosh, I wish I could go to where the Codebreakers were, because we didn't even know it was there. So it's almost like finding a new diary of Churchill or Patton or somebody great in the war, because this is a virgin territory for people that love history. So how do they find him? What's the, you know, the best time to visit there? What would you recommend?
Oh, I mean, it's really simple to get to. It is one train journey. It's 50 miles north of London. I think it takes 45 minutes, 50 minutes to get there.
Right.
And one of the reasons it was set up there is because it's literally across the road from the local railway station.
So it's practicality is all.
Yeah, basically. And that was known as the Varsity Line at the time because it was the midpoint between Oxford and Cambridge, where obviously, you know, the major universities were.
Right, right.
When veterans visit Bletchley Park, it's fascinating to find out what they did here. In Nancy Jackson's case, it wasn't quite what she thought. Like many who worked here, she didn't know how her specific job fitted into the code-breaking operation. She described herself as a tiny cog. What sort of impression have you got today, visiting now, seeing the sort of the bigger picture?
The complexity of it. I was interested in the Admiral, I forget his name now, who came down from Whitehall, who was a senior admiral, and was also apparently interested in code-breaking, I think. And he had thought that they wouldn't be able to remain in London doing their work there because they couldn't be vulnerable to bombing, and which London obviously was going to be. And so he had worked out that Bletchley Park was an ideal geographical place, if you like. It was on a direct road to London. It had a direct rail link, not only with London, but also with Oxford and Cambridge. And they knew they were going to need to have a large amount of help from Oxford and Cambridge, particularly mathematicians, of course. I thought that was quite interesting. I was interested also to hear about, there was a family living in the house.
Yes, Bud,
Four children, and he was in charge of transport. He was pointing out how important it was because there are three ways of entering, and he'd got coaches and people being billeted all around Bedfordshire and quite a wide radius, all coming in, and sometimes a large number of them at a time, and he needed to make certain that they didn't sort of cross over with each other.
It's quite a logistical operation, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
It was a factory, really, wasn't it? A code-breaking factory, running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
I suppose, yes, it was, really.
Bletchley's open every day of the year, apart from Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and New Year's Day.
Which is lucky for you, hopefully, because that's in about a day from now, and hopefully you can sleep in.
And it's much in the news now with not just the movie that's coming up here, but also the Bletchley Circle. That's ladies, and something we haven't mentioned here is the role of women. This was a real opportunity for women. We talked about the architecture of the building being kind of patchwork and no one thing. This was really an opportunity. If you were good at math, they didn't care who or what you were. They kind of wanted you in there. It was an opportunity for these young women to come and help.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't realize, I mean, at its very height near the end of the war, there were 10,000 people working there.
Wow.
And basically 3/4 of those people were women.
Amazing.
In all kinds of roles, in code breaking roles, yes. You know, a lot of the Wrens were just doing quite laborious jobs of running the bomb machines, which broke the Enigma codes.
Right.
But all kinds of walks of life as well, from, you know, debutantes and upper class ladies to, you know, just local girls who worked as tea girls, basically.
Call to service. You know, one of the interesting things about the Bletchley Circle, and it speaks to what I imagine was a phenomenon post-war, is so you had these women who did such important work, who were then expected to, after the war, to go home and get the apron back on and forget about all that.
We recently went to the press launch for the new series, which is about to start, and the writer said exactly that. I mean, it's the whole basis of the program, you know. It is the fact that, as you say, these women did really important jobs that, if it hadn't been the war, yeah, they wouldn't have been doing that. They probably would have got married and had children and been housewives. But they'd been taken out of that. They'd been put into a completely new world where what they did was as important as the guy who sat next to them. And then at the end of the war, well, they were just expected to stop and just go back to what their lives were meant to be, or what society said their lives were meant to be. So, I mean, it does sort of, you know, it's based on that, it plays on that. And I think it's a really good series. I mean, to be honest, we've seen some of the new series and it looks beautifully shot.
Oh, great. I'm looking forward to it. Again, as an Englishman, I wonder, do you have a sense of, obviously, you're a much younger man and you certainly weren't around even at the end of the war, but is your England viewed through the post-war lens in any significant way? Do you have a sense of, you know, talking to your uncles or your grandfather or your dad or whomever about how English life, you know, this Bletchley Circle notion, you know, about the women being putting the aprons back on being one idea of this, is there any sort of shift with which you are aware or culturally aware on the other side of this war, other than the fact that, you know, you're not speaking German?
I've always had an interest in history and you know, especially World War II.
Right.
So, you know, I'm never sure if my amount of knowledge is, you know, on that subject is more than most people. It possibly is because it's something I'm so fascinated by. But it's only recently, I think, that people really have come to terms with what happened, you know, and how people had to put their lives on hold and just give service to their country, really. And everything had to be forgotten about, you know, marriage, children, you know, your future.
Right.
Because, you know, at the dark days of 1940 and 41, we didn't really have a future, really.
That's so true. I mean, let's hear a little bit from Prime Minister Winston Churchill on that very thing right now. Let's give a listen.
We must expect that as soon as stability is reached on the Western Front, the bulk of that hideous apparatus of aggression, which dashed Holland into ruin and slavery in a few days, will be turned upon us. I'm sure I speak for all when I say we are ready to face it, to endure it, and to retaliate against it to any extent that the unwritten laws of war permit. There will be many men and many women in this island who, when the ordeal comes upon them, as come it will feel comfort and even a pride that they are sharing the perils of our lads at the front. Soldiers, sailors, and airmen, God bless them, and are drawing away for them a part, at least, of the onslaught they have to bear. Is not this the appointed time for all to make the utmost exertions in their power?
Churchill was able to go out there and speak about all this, everything that he thought when he was in the war, every word that he thought he could marshal and, you know, send into battle, as Thatcher would later say. he could go and he could talk about it. After the war was over, he could go and he could write his memoirs and he could have a word for himself. These mostly women that were working at Bletchley Park, but also the men, you said go back home. And it just reminded me of that. You know, there was no blogging. There was no writing a book on your experience. There was no, you know, there was no way that they could really share that. And so
telling your wife or husband.
Yeah, no, right? Nothing. Yeah, as your see parents. In Bletchley Circle. And I wanted to, that's why I wanted to ask before we got too far along so people understand. Tell us what the Official Secrets Act was, because that's really synonymous with the story of Bletchley Park. And it remains secret, not because it was unimportant, but because it was so important.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, every single person who worked at Bletchley Park signed the Official Secrets Act. And I mean, there's all kinds of different tales. You get tales from some that they went into a room and there was a major stood in front of them with a service revolver in his hand, basically saying, you sign this, you never tell anyone about anything that ever happens here or I will shoot you. Mm. I think, you know, that's been worked up a little, but
sure,
every single person signed that Official Secrets Act. And as far as they were concerned, they signed that, they were never, ever going to talk about it. I mean, we still now have veterans who will not talk about it. Last year, we had a visit from the Duchess of Cornwall, and there was a group of 50 or so Wrens there on tables, and the Duchess went round and she went to different groups of them and went to speak to all of them. You know, she was saying to all the ladies, oh, where did you work? What did you do? She got to one of the ladies and she said, I worked in Hut 18. All right, and what did you do in there? I worked in Hut 18. And she will not say anything about what she did, because as far as she's concerned, she signed the OSA and she will never speak
about it. She signed it in blood, you know, in a sense.
You know, you can only respect how they feel about it. If they want to talk about it, it's great. I mean, that's what we say to them. We always say to the veterans, if they're there and we get a chance to interview them, you know, would you like to talk about it?
Right.
And to be honest, most of them will talk about it. But, you know, as you've said, there are people who worked there who were married for donkey's years. And once the story had come out, then they finally turned around to each other and said, oh, I used to work there. Did you? So did I. And they wouldn't have known. And this had been 30 years by that point.
Mark, before we go much further with this, for folks outside of the UK who may not know, please, who is the Duchess of Cornwall?
That's Prince Charles's wife.
That would be Camilla Parker Bowles, I guess, for most folks here who look at the tabloids. Now, the center fell out in, what, was it 1973?
Yes.
When someone broke their vow, essentially.
Yeah, you know? Frank Winterbottom.
Yeah, we talk about him in our Coventry podcast.
Yeah, it's even now, his name isn't well loved by the veterans. Most of them feel that he betrayed them, even the ones who are happy to talk about it now.
When I went home on my first leave, my mother said, what are you going to be doing? I said, Mum, I can't tell you. They never, ever inquired again. My husband never asked me what I was doing.
Mine didn't know until after this 30-year.
And when Group Captain Winterbottom wrote the book, and it was...
That was a shock.
Do you know, I was horrified. The people I was still knew said, how could he do that? We thought he'd be taken to task over it, but he wasn't. So we think that because technology had passed us, it wasn't that important to keep it secret.
We couldn't believe it. This friend of mine, a Wren, who lives here, and that I worked with, called me up to tell me about the book.
I mean, I've even heard some veterans talk about he should have been tried for treason and it's a shame we still didn't have hanging.
Wow.
They feel that strongly about it. I mean, just the fact that, you know, the Coventry myth, that's where the Coventry myth comes from. And it, you know, it is a total myth. He didn't know the full story. I mean, there's only, it's estimated there were probably less than, you know, two dozen people, if not less, that actually knew the entire story of Bletchley Park.
Right. And this man was not one of them.
No.
And I can imagine the outrage, because again, this is something where one has to cast their mind back a bit and look at what was at stake for your island. And what was at stake? Everything.
Yeah.
Your British life.
Yeah, go watch the movie Hitler's Britain, and it gives you an idea of what they would have faced.
Mm.
You know, you go look at what the Nazis were doing in the occupied countries, really. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't Dad's War there in the UK, wasn't Allo Allo in France. And in Greece, there were so many terrible, terrible things that happened in the occupation. Winterbotham wrote The Ultra Secret in 1974, revealed a lot of this intel and things that he had sort of half a story about. But also, I wanted to mention another story that you had told us another time, Mark, or let you tell it rather, about just how seriously people took this. I mean, there were people, weren't there, that they thought their sons and daughters had not served and not done anything in the war of note because they didn't go to war.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many tales of people, you know, on their father's deathbeds, you know, wanting to tell them that I wasn't a disgrace to the family. I did serve, because at the time, most men especially would have been in uniform, and these people, a lot of them weren't in uniform. They were civilians still, but they had to do that work at Bletchley. They had no choice in the matter, really. And, you know, they couldn't at the end of the war just go, well, I've helped win that war, in a way. And, you know, families disowned sons and daughters because they thought they hadn't served. And they thought, you know, because the cover story was Bletchley Park was an offshoot of the civil service. It was just clerical work being right. done there. That was all it was. And that was the cover story. And, you know, people thought, well, you had an easy war.
What was that, one of your veterans? She wrote a book, I think it's the Department of Fish and Ag. She was talking about how she had to tell everyone she worked at the Department of Fish and Agriculture or something.
There's all kinds of, yeah, some were Foreign Office, some were, you know, oh, it's a filing outstation for the Foreign Office, right. and all kinds of things.
Mark, you're a unique guest in that you come bearing gifts, which is nice considering we're recording this on my birthday in your time. Thank you. It's just the right size. Sound bites. Let's hear a bit of your interview with Wynne Ribchester. She was a 13-year-old girl when the fighting broke out and actually lived in Bletchley Park during the 4 years of the war.
When you were interviewed, is this true that you signed the Official Secrets Act?
Oh, yes, completely true.
What age were you when that happened?
13.
Were you given a stiff talking to, or was it just a noisy
interview? No, it was rather funny, really, because my father really hammered it into us. You must not talk about anything. Well, he met me at the gate, and I thought, what the devil does he want? And he said, oh, some people want to talk to you. So we went into the mansion. I couldn't believe it. It was absolutely buzzing. Telephones, teleprinters, clattering noise, typewriters. And it was interesting because on all the doors, there were little plaques with numbers and letters on, no names. We went up to the first floor and he pushed me into this room and said, there's some people want to talk to you, I'll wait out here. No explanation. And I went in and I was confronted by a long table going from side to side, covered in a grey army blanket. Seated at the table, there were three very high-ranking officers, one from each of the services. In front of each man was a brand-new, unused notepad and a pencil and his service cap. And it amused me faintly because every peak of the service caps were pointing in the same direction, all very military. And the man in the middle was army. I think he was a colonel. And he set off by saying, you know, name and all that stuff. And then he said, when you're at school, do the other children ask you what's going on here? Oh, I said, yes, all the time. And they all leaned forward rather anxiously and said, and what do you say? So I said, well, it's just a lot of civil servants from London. Because that's what my father said, you know, you mustn't say anything else. So that seemed to satisfy them. And then he said, are you ever approached by grown-ups or on the train or in the town? I said, no. And that was it. And then he made a great long speech about how important Bletchley Park was and that it was absolutely vital that nothing should be discussed or given away at all. And he really hammered this point home. And then he fished into his briefcase and put out a document in front of me and said rather solemnly, this is the Official Secrets Act. I could see that because it was on the top. And he said, it's a solemn pledge, a solemn promise, because this place has got to be kept very secret. And he went on and on. And then he handed me a very, very posh fountain pen. And he said, you must write your name in capitals there and then sign it and date it. So I did that. And he said, thank you for coming. And I went to join my father. And as I went out, I heard someone chuckle. And I was prickly little devil, actually. And I said, they're laughing at me. He said, no, they aren't. He said, they're laughing because you're the youngest ever to sign the OSA. Because I was 13. And, you know, they needn't have bothered. It was obviously very, very heavily stage managed to impress a schoolgirl. But, as I said, I'd had it dinned into me, my father, so they were, you know, it was really a bit of a rain dance.
What was it like? I mean, just generally, being a child, I mean, could you play in the grounds at all?
No, and I couldn't have any visitors. I never had a birthday party or a birthday tea, and I never had friends in to play with me. They just were not allowed. And one Saturday, a couple of my chums came up to the park and said, oh, can we go in and see Wynne, you see?
And they were told in no uncertain terms to push off. So all my friendships were very one-sided. I could see them, but they couldn't see me. So it was lonely, really. But you just put up with things as a child, don't you? You adapt.
Did you ever get a chance to talk to your parents about what was actually happening here after the war, sort of years later? When...
No, my father never said a word. And when we went back to Twickenham to live, and I said, well, where are you working? And he said, I'm working in London. End of conversation. And that was that.
Thank you so much, Wynne.
You're very welcome.
The fact that she remembers which way the caps were pointing. I mean, yeah. Somebody 13, you'd think, would remember it better than an adult. But then you talk, Mark, sometimes to adults on the Bletchley Park podcast that they have really good recall, too. This was all just such flashbulb memory.
It's remarkable. I mean, how spry they all are is amazing. I mean, obviously, to be at Bletchley, you know, they're obviously not going to be, you know, really ill or anything, you know, to have come and made a visit.
Sure.
But, I mean, they're just amazing. I mean, that their spirit and their, you know, the life in them is just fantastic. I mean, Joyce, that we spoke about earlier, I mean, she had a sort of a walking frame affair on wheels, and she was shooting off around the park. I couldn't keep up with her. It was,
yeah.
It was remarkable. But, yeah, I mean, little things like, you know, we found recently with the bomb machine, which, if you ever see a picture of it, it's a loads and loads of drums on this machine.
Right.
And they were to recreate each set of three drums recreated an Enigma machine. So basically this thing went through and it tried all the permutations of what that day's settings could be. And what the Wrens had to do was this really laborious job at the end of it. They'd take the drums off at the end of a run, and they had a pair of tweezers in their hands, and on the back of the drums, it's all tiny, tiny, tiny little pieces of piano wire. And that's how it made the electrical connections. And they had a pair of tweezers, and they had to go around every single one of these wires, and there's something like 150, 160 of them. And they had to make sure each one was on its own, it wasn't touching another one, because that would short circuit, and
right.
The next run wouldn't work. And we found, just giving them one of these drums from the rebuild that's been made, and literally they just run their fingers over it, and it's like, oh, that takes me back. And all of a sudden, everything just spills out. Oh, we did this and we did that. And or the sound of the bomb running. It's brilliant. It's little cues like that that sort of fire off their imagination, I think.
And the Enigma machine, I was saying to Owen, just to wrap our head around as modern people, when they managed to finally capture an Enigma machine, which they named Operation Primrose, U-110, they managed to capture a German U-boat,
right.
Keep it very secretly. HMS Bulldog brings it in. They give you an Enigma machine. It's not as if this is your decoder ring with Captain Video and you drink your Ovaltine and figure it out. This is not only they speaking in code and in German and using passwords, but you have to have so many permutations to get this right. The Enigma machine itself wasn't going to necessarily always produce the right intelligence, even though they did have it.
No, definitely. I mean, the settings were changed every single day at midnight, and there were different settings for different groups. So you had, you know, Luftwaffe would use one set of code books, the U-boats would use another. As the war went on, there were different flavours of Enigma. So you had Enigma machines with three rotors, you had Enigma machines with four rotors. It wasn't just one code that needed to be broken every day. It was a series of codes that needed to be broken.
If some great misfortune put me in front of an Enigma machine, all would have been lost. But math, no.
Well, it's that. It's things like that. It's human error that gave Bletchley the first ins to Enigma, because these operators were doing the same tasks each and every day. So with the U-boats, you know, they were sending weather reports, basically.
Right.
They'd start each message with a weather report. So Bletchley codebreakers had things called cribs, so they would be looking for certain things. So they'd know that if a U-boat was sending a message, then it would probably start talking about the weather. So they could have a guess at, you know, today's weather or whatever, however it was worded. And then they'd literally just try and line up the words that were coming out of the decoded Enigma messages with what they guessed what that message might start with. And simple mistakes by the operators, little things like starting the Enigma, they had a setting for each day, but they had to send a message first And that message, they just picked a setting for those three rotors. So it would be something that they would use every day, probably. So it was those human errors that enabled us to get some of those early breaks.
That's amazing. And let's, before we go any further here, we've referenced this Coventry myth, and we've Angry History, we've done an entire podcast on it. In brief, this Coventry myth that this F.W. Winterbotham was responsible for spreading like a disease is that Winston Churchill and everyone, they had foreknowledge of an attack on the city of Coventry. And this Winterbotham's thought was that it was kept a secret. People knew that this city was going to be attacked, and it was allowed to be attacked because if we stopped the attack, the Germans would have known that we had broken their code. That's it in a nutshell, right?
That's it.
Okay.
Ohm was saying, talking about if they threw him in front of an Enigma machine. You can actually see them when you go there, right, Mark?
There's an entire collection. We think it's the largest collection in the world on public display. There's all kinds of Enigmas. As I was saying, the different types and the different flavors. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's even one that was donated to Bletchley last year that the Germans gave to the Spanish during the Spanish Civil War and had literally been in a cupboard in Madrid for 70 years.
Wow. Now, we can't talk about Bletchley Park and we can't talk about Enigma without talking about a man named Alan Turing, who is a major towering figure in this entire narrative. Briefly, Mark, who was Alan Turing?
He was a genius mathematician, basically. He's more or less known as the father of computing because in 1936 he wrote a paper which basically explained how a computer would work. And he was the sort of person that they realized with this change in the way codes were being generated through machines that they needed someone with that sort of brain and that sort of logic based on mathematics to be able to break these machines.
Right. Now, we've been hearing about him in the news recently because he was given a pardon by the Crown. And
posthumously.
Posthumously. His crime was being gay.
And
his life was certainly upended. He was...
His punishment,
He was subjected to hormone treatment.
Chemical castration very unpleasant phrase.
The last 2 years of his life were a living hell. He finally took his own life.
Well, how old was he, Mark? 41? A young man.
Yeah.
I mean, if looking at it from certainly a modern perspective, in a lot of places, you look at a man who many give a great deal of credit to for saving his country. And then he was also treated absolutely barbarically by his country.
Yeah. I mean, it was all part, again, of the secrecy of Bletchley Park, really, that, you know, people wouldn't have known that he'd done what he'd done during the war.
And this movie is called The Imitation Game, and Benedict Cumberbatch plays Alan Turing, right?
Yes, he does. Awesome. And, I mean, we've spoken to some leading Turing experts and members of the family as well, and they're all just so happy that Benedict got the role. They think he's absolutely perfect for it.
Oh, great. Yeah,
that, everything that guy touches turns to gold. He's fantastic. Except for Star Trek. Sorry. I have to say it.
He saw me glaring across the studio.
There's a little production note here, folks. Dean and I are in the same room doing this podcast. And the only other time that's happened so far is when we were in McSorley's doing the Slocum one. So we're actually able to make eye contact, which is kind of a hilarious and fun way to do this.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Star Trek came up. Sorry.
He was hired very, very late in that, I will point out. And there wasn't much in that, the way that they wrote Khan to really sink his teeth into.
Yeah,
so.
No. Let's see. I mean, he made a pan de merde, much more palatable, if you will.
This is a good time to transition into this living legend that you brought us. This was so great of you, Mark.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It was a no-brainer. I mean, when you guys first got in touch with me about the Coventry episode you'd done, and I'd already recorded Sir Arthur once, strangely enough, at a Mythbusters event that we'd held, and Coventry had come up, and I knew I had this audio, but then serendipity jumped in again, and we knew that Sir Arthur was coming over to Bletchley. Doesn't talk about his work very often, but he was coming over to be filmed by PBS for a upcoming documentary that they're going to be showing, and it was just a no-brainer. We need to ask him this question for you guys, basically. And he was just no problem with it at all. Oh, of course I will. Absolutely.
This was a major get as you say. I just kept thinking that when you told us that you talked to him and then you agreed to let us use it. Again, we're talking about Sir Arthur Bonsall. He worked at Bletchley Park during the war. He rose to be director of the British Signals Intelligence Agency, GCHQ, from 1973 to 78. And that was actually the time when, as we said, F.W. Winterbotham came out with this book filled with a lot of the half-truths that gave rise to this Coventry myth that people are in love with. And we can go right into this clip of Sir Arthur talking about the Coventry myth and what he really thinks about it. And I mean, this is the horse's mouth. If anybody out there is still sort of believes this conspiracy theory, I think the way he puts it here is so succinct. I mean, we spent 80 minutes, whatever we spent on it. We didn't come as near the truth and authority that's in this man's voice. So let's give a listen.
We are correcting myths all the time because of the very nature of Bletchley during the war and the secrecy. It takes people firsthand being absolutely sure, with a pin-sharp memory, that this isn't what happened, this is what happened. So, while we've got you, we have to ask you about Coventry and the myth that Churchill knew that that was coming. I gather it's a complete myth.
It is a complete myth. There's not no information relevant to the attack, but it wasn't the sort of information that could have been reported as precise evidence. There were pointers to the fact there might be activity, no date or anything accurate like that. In fact, there were several such other incidents where Enigma traffic had referred to a future raid on somewhere or other in the UK. And I think the reporting staff in Hut 3 always reported this, but it was never any valid. And I was talking to RAF Fighter Command people after. They said it was no good telling us there's going to be a raid two nights ahead, because the chances are the raid won't take place anyhow because the weather won't be suitable. So it's not a definite thing. And in any case, even if it were definite, what could we have done about it? You can't put aircraft up and keep them waiting for possible arrival. You can only react to actual events. Those reports, warnings of raids on places in Britain were really of no real intelligence value.
The nicest thing about this clip as well is where it was recorded, because we recorded that in the room that was Alistair Denniston's office during World War II. So he was the operational director at Bletchley Park. And it's basically where the special relationship between Britain and the US was formulated.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's great to paint the picture there. I mean, you have to have so many moments speaking to these people where you just don't, you don't feel worthy to be in their presence. You're just so honored and in awe of them.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah. You know,
it's so great. So, I mean, we're giddy here just to play it. So I can't imagine sitting there with the guy and, you know, it must be so much fun. It's really rarefied air that you're breathing. So.
Absolutely. And this is just fantastic too, that soundbite. And more evidence, as in our Coventry episode, that this myth just does not hold water.
Not at all.
Mark, do you guys have the phrase false flag in the UK?
Yeah,
okay. It's one that's being, you know, spat about by people who actually seem to think they know what they're talking about. But it's false flag for everything these days. Everything we don't understand, or maybe it's just too much to comprehend. It's false flag. We have more from Sir Arthur here describing a day he got a surprise while walking to lunch at Bletchley Park.
You were here when Churchill visited.
Oh, yes.
What can you remember about
that? Well, what I remember about that is that there was absolutely no publicity beforehand. In fact, it was probably the reverse of that. Anyway, I didn't know he was coming, nor did any other ordinary member of this place. And it was during my lunch break. I was then, I think, working in Block A, I think. I was going to my lunch break, walking across, approaching this circular lawn from that direction. And as soon as I got inside the lawn, I noticed a group of, well, yes, young women clustered out here on the edge of the lawn. And as I came across it, I, to my astonishment, saw that they were listening to Churchill. I mean, the last thing I was expecting to encounter. And what had happened was he'd been visiting Hut 6 and Hut 8 and places like that earlier in the morning. A group of girls hadn't been spoken to by him. They were just juniors. He'd been dealing with the sort of the top circle breakers and so on. And they had all said to each other, well, we're not all going to say goodbye to him. So they guessed he would leave before lunchtime. And they had spent their lunch break standing outside there in a group, Churchill came out of the front door. His car was parked just outside these windows, big Daimler, just outside these windows, with an ATS driver sitting in it, looking straight ahead, nowhere else. And he wasn't making an important speech. I mean, it was just an exhortation. Carry on the good work, you know, that kind of thing. And I just managed to catch the final words. And he then got down off the stone he was standing on the edge of the lawn there, straight into his car. And by the time his car reached the corner there, he was already reading documents from a big red box.
Straight on to the next thing, before he'd even left the premises.
I think he was going up to lunch at Blenheim, I guess that was it. Haven't been able to prove that.
Winston Churchill once described the code breakers as, quote, the geese that laid the golden eggs, but never cackled, end quote. Here Sir Arthur describes how the stone where Churchill stood to give his speech came to be there on the lawn at Bletchley.
I do know that he stood on the stone where that peasant one is. And my guess is, after an incident in the previous year, in 1940, he came in 1941, previous year, it was a sunny day in the summer of 40, and various people were standing around on this bit of grass, and a sports car suddenly shot across it. The young man got his foot jammed on the accelerator, roared across, fortunately not hitting anybody or anything, but the management here immediately recognised the danger that, you know, there always were likely to be people hanging around out there on the grass on a nice day, and this might happen again. So I can't remember now how many days, but my memory is they seem to have reacted very quickly to have found a source of suitable stones to put round the grass, right round it, so no car could get onto it. And later, my guess is that they suddenly thought of there were some dry stone walls in the rock garden. They knocked them down and got the big stones out of the bottom, enough big stones for, say, 30 or 40 stones, something like that. The gardeners got a wheelbarrow and they wheeled them and they put them around this. Within days, it couldn't happen again. And it seemed to me that it'd be quite an idea to put a little memorial of this event in the form of a stone. So Julie and I, with the aid of the gardener here, were shown some possible stones which he had found in the...
Well, I think we looked at them in the bottom of the lake,
didn't we? Yes, yes. Anyway, there were lots of stones in the bottom of the lake. And I think what happened at the end of the war, when the post office took over this place as a training establishment, they didn't want these great stones around the grass because it made it difficult to cut the grass up against a big stone. And the nearest place to dump them was in the lake. So that's where, and there are a lot there now. And I think that, and hope that, restoring it to its wartime appearance will include getting these stones out of the lake and putting them back in a ring around the grass.
Well, if we do, I wonder what else we might find at the bottom of that lake.
Yes, indeed.
Good to think.
And now, have you seen that stone, these stones that he's talking about, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, the room that we recorded that in, you look out the window and it's in front of you. It sits right in front of the entrance to the mansion. And myself and Catherine, when we were recording that, because, you know, our main point was just to ask Sir Arthur about some other points, and then we wanted to ask the specific question about Coventry. And then he just started talking about Churchill again. And we'd never heard the full story of how the stones had arrived there.
Wow. Anytime you can go and stand. I mean, I've been up to Chartwell, to Churchill's home, but just to be able to look and touch those parts of history, you can get that at Bletchley Park. And it's new. Not that Buckingham Palace isn't great.
Well,
not that
sure.
Any of these things aren't. Not that the cabinet worms, I always still want to call them. Mm-hmm. The Churchill worms aren't great. This is a little off the beaten path, and it's something you can go to and really experience it. And you also have some of these code breakers as sort of guides there, don't you? People can interact with some of them sometimes, can't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for a start, we've got Wrens who were bomb operators during the war, who most of the year will be demonstrators on the bomb machine. And when people suddenly realise, oh, this lady did this during the war, it's just, they're just fascinated, you know, they're just, most of the visitors are just in awe of them, and, you know, rightly so, to be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting, you talked to Ian, you mentioned maybe, you know, if one is planning their vacation or trip to England, and, I mean, Bletchley is a 45-minute ride out of London, like you said, Mark, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Consider going, because you can actually be in a place that were not for this place, our world would be a vastly different one right now than the one we have
without
today.
A doubt. I mean, President Eisenhower said sometime after the war that he felt the work that Bletchley Park had done during the war had possibly led to the war being shortened by up to 2 years. And if you think on average 10 million people a year were dying by that stage, well,
wow.
Even just that, you've saved 20 million lives.
This is really the human element. And you talk about those stones. I mean, I was thinking of how, what if that car had been a runaway? I mean, he's sort of chuckling there. Obviously, they were knowing death was around every day. But, you know, what if a car came careening through there and killed one of these codebreakers, killed Alan Turing, or even took him out of commission for a few days? I also like the note that they put rocks there instead of putting guards or snipers, because
right.
Again, people would wonder, well, why are you having all these guards around what's supposed to be a clerical institution? You know, it would have raised questions. And these were all very human, real, everyday issues that they would have to deal with. You know, they were constantly thinking secrecy, secrecy, secrecy. How do we keep this secret? And people love to be let in on a secret. And when you can go there and sit in one of those huts and say, look at this room, like you said, it was just a temporary thing thrown up.
Yep.
You can be in there and say, gosh, it's 70 years ago. This was one of the most important places on earth.
Without a doubt.
In this little humble hut. And you can't stand in many places like that. Here was the balance of the war. These people crunching numbers and working on these really beautiful machines. I think all these dramatizations, you have to have a pretty positive outlook, because it seems like they're all done with great respect, aren't they?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, just recently, I was the same when we went to the press launch for Bletchley Circle, the actors, without prompting, all of them were just talking about what pride they had in being involved in it. And, you know, they'd done their homework. They knew about codebreakers that had worked there, women that had worked there during the war. And you could just tell how proud they were in being involved with it. I think, you know, it's a story that, in a way, it's just a good story. I mean, okay, some of the information would lead to people being killed, but at the end of the day, it's not a story about someone standing there shooting someone. It's just really good story about how a group of people came together, mathematical geniuses, linguists, professors, but ordinary people as well. And yes, they made some amazing technological leaps during the war, but also it just boiled down to them using their brains and common sense to break something that should have been unbreakable.
Mark, we wanted to mention one other gift that you sent us.
It was the most unexpected and coolest thing.
Yeah. You took Angry Washington, our little mascot there, or whatever you want to call him off our Angry History logo, and you put it somewhere, and you sent us pictures of it. So why don't you tell the people listening where you put this?
A lot of people probably first got to know about Bletchley Park from the film Enigma. And during the filming, they made so many models, but one of the larger scale models is on the grounds of Bletchley Park. So it just seemed perfect that Angry Washington should be the logo on the U-boat.
It was awesome. It was a thrill. And it's funny, you know, not to be too corny about it, but just to see that even for a little while existed on the side of that sub was just a real kick and a real thrill. Thanks a lot, Mark.
No problem.
We appreciate it. And we really just want to suggest to people, share the story. If you're on Twitter, you should be following at B-Park Podcast, and you should, you know, please follow us at Angry History, but spread the word about it a little bit, that this is a real place.
And when I think about your podcast, and if I can impart anything to anyone listening to this, for us, blowing the dust off of history is one of the things that we love. And your podcast is just so current because of all the veteran participation that you have. And it is so warm. And it is offers me, every time I hear it, a glimpse into the heart of a country. I tell you, I'm thrilled to have discovered it. Great stuff.
Oh, thank you. I mean, the feeling's mutual. I mean, obviously, we're very focused on one subject. But in the same way, you know, what you're doing with Angry History, is, you know, that's why we've made this connection. Because where you're coming from, you can just tell the passion that both of you have for history and for getting it right.
Well, that's sort of the thing, isn't it?
It's the goal, yeah. We just wanted to see if we could do something where you just say, okay, this is the historical mean, and there's some basic things that are facts as well as we can know them. Go to primary sources and get them out there. And that's why when we, oh my God, there's a podcast about the Enigma machine and the operation to crack the Nazi code. That's the source. We can go right there and say, look, is there any truth to this myth? And, you know, let's hear from the people who really experienced it.
That's it. We don't have to rely always on a historian. In this case, we hear from these actual people who were there, and you and Catherine and the Bletchley Park podcast bringing to us. And gosh, can't thank you enough.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure, gents.
Again, you can subscribe to the Bletchley Park podcast on iTunes. You can also learn more about their work to preserve the legacy of the Codebreakers like Sir Arthur, Win Ribchester, and the late Alan Turing and others at bletchleypark.org.uk, and give them a listen. Most people really binge on those podcasts. They're like potato chips. And,
I do.
You know, chips, I guess you call something different over there, right?
Crisps.
Right. Chips or French fries, crisps or potato chips.
Yeah. I mean, we do the monthly episode, but then also we do Bletchley Park podcast extras. So they're for people who are really, really into it. So, you know, we'll record events and talks, and they're more for people who really want to get into the nitty gritty of Bletchley, really.
Yep. There are things at all levels. Well, listen, Mark Cotton, thank you once again. Special thanks to Sir Arthur Bonsall for agreeing to answer those questions for us about the Coventry myth.
We want to leave you with another period piece. Mark was talking about how memories can be brought back by these people at Bletchley Park who served there even 70 years later. And so we have a song here by the Three Bells. Young girls who just decided, hey, they love Andrew Sisters. They love that big band music. And they go out, perform places like Bletchley Park, like the Churchill War Rooms.
Hi, we're the Three Bells. The Second World War was a time when everybody sacrificed, from the home front to the front lines, from rationing sugar and petrol to women pitching in for war work at places like Bletchley Park.
To honour those who lived through those sterner days, us Bells will swap the Christmas ham for Spam in the last half of January.
We'll be following the strict guidelines of a 1940s ration book, all to raise money for the Royal British Legion, the UK's leading charity for the millions who serve in uniform and their families.
You can support our Slimming for Victory by making a donation or even joining us in taking the ration book challenge.
If you're brave enough!
Get the details, share recipes, and watch our progress at thethreebells.com.
So we'll leave you with that now. We'll thank you again very much, Mark, for being with us. I'm Dean Carianis.
I'm Owen Mugen.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some, until I first met you, I was lonesome. And when you came in sight, dear, my heart grew light, and this whole world seemed to me. You're really swell, I have to admit you. Deserve expressions that really fit you. And so I rack my brain open to explain all the things that you do to me. By me, beast to shame, please let me explain. By me, beast to shame, is that your grand? By me, beast to shame, again I'll explain. It means you're the fairest. By me, beast of shame is such an overbrain, and yet I should explain. It means I am begging for your hand. I could say bella, bella, even say wunderbar. Each language only helps me tell you how.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.
Say that you will understand.